Let's open our Bible, please, on 1 Peter chapter 2. We're going to be reading from verse 11. We saw last week that we are all undercover priests, all of us. We all have access, that we're all constantly spiritually online 24/7 to God. And that he wants us to pray, he wants us to contact him, talk to him, any time of day or of night. We just want to, we can open the gates of heaven and just stroll in. They're not locked against us. We can walk into God's presence whenever we like. And Peter now is going to expand his thinking. And he's going to look in wider terms. We're undercover priests. What does that mean in day-to-day life? What does that mean that we have this connection with God through Jesus Christ? How does that work itself out at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning? So let's read from verse 11. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers. I hate them. Why do they say aliens? You know, sorry, you're not ETs. You don't look like ET to me. Dear friends, I urge you as migrants and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as a supreme authority or to governors, who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the King. We begin with a life shape. And we begin with the life shape triangle. You've seen me use it often before. I cannot recommend it enough to you. It's about balancing your life as a follower, as an undercover priest. So what do undercover priests do? Well, they have a balanced life. They have an upward life. They have a spiritual ministry with God. They're in connection, in contact with God 24/7. That's up. They have an inward connection to God's people. They work and pray and minister to God's people. And they have an outward ministry to the world. They live in society and minister to it. And the trick in a Christian life is to balance these three. To have a strong upward life, a solid inward life, and a wonderful, flamboyant, effective outward life to the world. Getting that right is difficult. I struggle with it. I really struggle with it. And getting that balance right is all about how you live effectively as a Christian. And we're going to see that this is the balance that Peter himself is using. But we'll come to that towards the end. We'll begin with looking as more at the outward world. How do you live in a society which is biased against Jesus? How do you live in a pagan society where many religions flourish? It was a problem for them, and it can be a problem for us as well. There have been Christian groups that solve the problem by retreating from the world altogether. And there used to be, there still is, I believe, a group known as the Closed Brethren who will not eat with non-believers. In fact, if you're not in their group, they won't sit down for a meal with you. And they try to be self-employed so they don't have to work for anybody who isn't a member of their group, who isn't a committed Christian. And if they're successful, they employ others from the group. They have almost zero contact with people outside their group. And if you leave the group, they'll cut you off and freeze you out. And that's not what Peter is saying. Peter takes a very different line. He encourages us to look out, but with caution. If we go to verse 11, he begins, "I urge you, friends, as migrants and strangers in the world, to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul." And Peter is saying this because he wants to put the basics down. He wants to put our feet firmly on the ground. He's going to say to us, listen, don't retreat from the world in case you get polluted by it. Your problem, your biggest problem is yourself. Your biggest problem is you. You and I, says Peter, I don't need the world to tempt me. I can manage that perfectly well on my own. My enemy of my soul is me. That's my big enemy. The big danger is that my sinful human nature gets the better of me. As one of my lawyer friends once said in court and was quoted in the newspaper, "Your Honour, my client's worst side got the better of him." That is our problem. But Peter says, listen, if you're self-disciplined, you can face the world with confidence. You can resist the temptation because you're self-disciplined on the inside. There used to be a Californian evangelist called Arthur Blessed, possibly the most extrovert person I've ever come across in my life. Used to walk around the world with a cross on wheels and just stop and talk to people. And he was incredibly successful. It was a time when the Spirit of God was moving powerfully among young people in the world. And many people became Christians. I became a Christian at that time, and many of my friends did. And he used to say, listen, you need to be insulated and not isolated. You need to be insulated. You need to stop the temptations getting into you. And if you're insulated, you don't need to worry about being isolated. You can be out there in the world working, but the temptations will not be finding a way through your armor. You can go wherever you need to go, and you can resist the temptations. What's on offer in the world may well damage our soul. But the problem is that I'm attracted to what's wrong for me. I have a huge capacity to wander on my own, and we'll be looking at that in a later study in Peter. So whether that's in the office, whether that's among a group of friends, whether it's our peer group culture that's pressing on us, perhaps it's my family culture. I've been brought up in a family culture that's really a long way from God. And the temptation is just to go along with my family culture. Perhaps it's my professional culture. And my professional culture is off-center. There's something desperately wrong in my professional culture that I need to resist. And I think for many of us, that's true. That's been true. We had our men's prayer meeting. We were talking in the coffee shop afterwards. And one of the guys said, you know, that this Staffordshire National Health Trust thing, terrible things going on in that hospital. He said the report said there was a culture in the hospital that they described as kiss up, kick down. And if you were caught in that culture, it was very difficult to survive. It was very difficult, and you got distracted. And people were caught up in a culture, a professional culture, that was not working. And it must have been incredibly difficult for the staff. If you're in that kind of situation, you're in a student culture, I don't need to spell that out to you. It's easy to go wrong. And when greed and pride and rage and jealousy happens, and it can happen within any of us, we can go wrong. But Peter says, look, don't cut yourself off. He's going to come back to this again and again. Don't cut yourself off from the world. Get involved in the world. But be self-disciplined as you do it. And in this passage, I think there are two main points. First, he encourages us to live a life of cautious benevolence. Let's move on to verse 12. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. He is not expecting Christians to be liked. It should come as no surprise to us that the Christian faith is pilloried in the press. Truth is, throughout 2,000 years, that's the normal for Christian faith. In any culture, in any country, Christians come under intense criticism. And Peter doesn't expect Christians to be understood. Doesn't expect people to like us, and he doesn't expect people to understand us. And I think he's not disappointed. The Roman writer described Christians around the time that Peter was writing as a group of people loathed because of their abominations. Does that sound like church to you? Suetonius, again writing not far from this time that Peter was writing, described Christians as a class of people animated by a novel and mischievous superstition. So how do you feel, guys, this morning? Do you feel animated by a novel and mischievous superstition this morning? Or are you followers of Jesus Christ? They said similar things about Jews, by the way. They had equally low opinion of the Jews. I've got some quotes here. Tacitus said that the Jews taught the people who converted to Judaism to despise the gods, to renounce their fatherland, to disregard their parents, children, brothers and sisters. Juvenal believed that Moses taught the Jews not to show anyone the way, nor to guide the thirsty traveller to the spring, unless he was a Jew. Appian declared that in the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Jews every year fattened a Greek, and having solemnly offered him up as a sacrifice on a fixed day in a certain forest, ate his entrails and swore eternal hostility to the Greeks. So Christians were misunderstood, misrepresented, and generally disliked. They were followers of a foreign superstition. The Roman Empire had loads and loads of different religions, and all kinds, and they changed. Some grew, some became more popular. Around this time, the Greek mystery religions were becoming very popular. They were very multi-sensory kind of events, and very powerful with music and cultic rites and things. You could consult the oracles. You could worship any number of gods in any number of ways. That was fine. As long as you remembered to sacrifice a little pinch of incense to the god called Caesar, the Roman emperor. And you could just, in some point in your life, or some point in your spiritual life, just pick a little fingerful of incense on the altar to the genius of the Caesar, of who was Lord, and declare that Caesar is Lord. That, as long as you did that, you could pretty much follow whatever religion you wanted. Now, Christianity, Christian faith, was not a religion. It was classed as a superstition. It was not recognized as a major religion in its own right. And that was dubious. They were dubious of foreign superstitions. They weren't sure about them at all. And they were very, I'm not saying paranoid. To call the Roman Empire paranoid is perhaps being unfair. It was always on difficult ground. It was huge. It was too big. They didn't have enough soldiers to man it. That was the truth. They could never be sure they would be able to resist two major attacks at the same time. They had soldiers stationed in Judah, where the Jews were always on the point of a riot. They had soldiers protecting their wheat fields in Egypt, in that area, in Alexandria, around there, which fed Rome. They had legions on the edges of the empire in so now modern Germany, keeping the barbarians out of the empire. And of course, they had Roman legions in Carnarvon. And you can see the danger in that, can't you? And keeping the Welsh under control, keeping the Scots was a nightmare. In the end, they had to build a wall. It didn't work, but they tried. So they were always on a knife edge. The last thing they needed was a revolt inside the empire. If the slaves would revolt, or the Jews would revolt, or something like that, that was a headache they could do without. So they were touchy. They were sensitive about things they didn't understand. And foreign superstitions came into the category suspicious. Now, if you're a Christian, how did that affect you? Well, it meant that you were looked at with suspicion, but there wasn't a magistrate would not arrest you. There wasn't a police force that would knock on your door for being politically incorrect. All right? Your trouble would have to come, if it came, from a member of the public. You could be denounced to the magistrate by a member of the public, but the magistrate would not come looking for you. And of course, the member of public who denounced you as a follower of a dubious foreign superstition, he would be exposed in front of the court as well. It was a dangerous place to be. People were not exactly desperate to go denouncing Christians. So most days it didn't happen. Most places it didn't happen. But you're always at risk. And now imagine you're a Christian grocer, okay? And you've got your Christian shop, you know, and it's lovely. And you're a good grocer. And you've got your cabbages, and you've got your cauliflowers, and you've got your beans, and you go around and you spray them with water to keep them looking fresh. And your suppliers are good, and it's great. Yeah? But down the road, there's a pagan greengrocer, and he's not as good as you. His stuff is wilting. And you're prospering, and he's not doing very well. What he would like is to get rid of opposition. So here's a chance. What if he comes and denounces you before the magistrate as a follower of a foreign superstition, a subversive speaking against the public, somebody who's antisocial? He will not take part in the annual festival to our town's patron god. He does not have any idols in his house. He's an atheist. He's irreligious. He's dangerous. And what if, perhaps, if the magistrate is not averse to a little bit of a bribe from aforesaid grocer? Suddenly, your position is difficult. And most magistrates had enough to get on with without having to solve silly little squabbles like that. And the magistrate would listen, and your denunciation that you were doing all kinds of abominable things, terrible things are happening, and you'd be denying them. And the magistrate really perhaps might not want to be bothered by this. So he'd say, well, look, all right, tell you what, I'm not interested in this. Just go to the temple, sacrifice to Caesar, and bring me a certificate to show that you sacrificed to Caesar, and that'll be fine. But you see, you're a Christian, you can't do that. You can't sacrifice to Caesar. You cannot go there and say that Caesar is Lord. And so you'd have to say to the magistrate, I can't do that. And he'd say, why? Don't you believe that Caesar is Lord? And now you're in a difficult situation because Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. You've got to try and explain that without provoking him even more. And he'd say, now you're being obstinate. And now I'm going to torture you until you do what I tell you. And you could be tortured, you could be killed, and some Christians were. It did happen. Later on, people would start doing a market in fake certificates. You'd go and buy a fake certificate as if you had sacrificed to Caesar. That really didn't go down well in the churches. They weren't too pleased with people, Christians, doing that. So that is the situation of the average Christian in Peter's day. That's the situation of the Christians he's writing to. He knows they could only be one denunciation away from the torture chamber. And I could tell you the tortures the Romans used, but you wouldn't sleep tonight, so I won't. You can look it up on the internet if you're interested. So how does Peter say? What does Peter do? Peter wants people to become Christians. Peter wants us to live outwardly. Peter wants us to have an out life. Peter wants us to relate to society, but he doesn't particularly want us to get ourselves killed as we do it. So Peter uses, I think, what we would call the softly, softly, non-confrontational approach to evangelism. I realize that was not the approach used by the Apostle Paul. And it's not the approach used by some evangelical churches these days who are very aggressive. But Peter's style is non-confrontational evangelism. Sharing your faith softly. I mean, just think if all the Christians were like, because the Apostle Paul ended up getting thrown out of everywhere that he turned up. So if all the Christians adopted Paul's approach, they'd all get thrown out of everywhere, wouldn't they? And it'd be no good at all. So it's not going to work for everybody. He says that you're going to be criticized. Just make sure that people don't have any real grounds for denouncing you. A later writer, writing maybe 200 years later, a guy called Minucius Felix, a man, incidentally, who had come to faith by seeing Christians martyred and being so impressed by their faith and their belief that he himself had become a Christian. But he wrote a Christian work proclaiming the Christian faith. Interestingly enough, without mentioning the name of Jesus once, it's all philosophy. It's called the Octavius. And he has this line in it, it's a famous line from it. He says, we don't preach great things, we live them. We don't preach great things, we live them. The Christian bishop of Carthage, a man called Cyprian, was martyred for his faith. And that made a huge impact in people. But some time before he'd been martyred, there was a plague in Carthage. And many of the wealthy pagans packed their bags and ran. The Christian leadership, including Cyprian, stayed and ministered to the sick and to the dying. Live as free people. Live as servants of God. Rob Bell says this: the church is at its best when it gives itself away. That's a fantastic quote. The church is at its best when it gives itself away. So many churches, I'm doing a report on small churches at the moment, and small churches get tied in on themselves and get nervous. They fear they're losing everything. They need to learn that they're at their best when they give themselves away. And when they start giving themselves away, they'll start interacting with their community and things will start happening. Beware of a sterile church that has pure doctrine but no engagement with society. That evangelical ghetto, which frightens me to death. That's what worries me more than anything. It's not newspaper denunciations. It's not anti-Christian polemic. It's ghetto mentality among the Christians. That's what frightens me more than anything. Christians closing ranks, shutting the door, pulling up the drawbridge and saying, our doctrine is perfect. Aren't we doing well? Well, no, you're not. Because there's no out. In what you do, you got the in and you got the up, but the out's missing. You're unbalanced. So a life of cautious benevolence, he says. A life of cautious civil duty. He unpacks this now in verses 13 to 15. If you just go back a couple of verses, where he says, interesting enough, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority, to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong or commend those who do right. Interestingly enough, he's writing this just a couple of years at the most before he himself is going to be martyred by Nero. He's writing this under the shadow of the maniac called the Emperor Nero. And the Emperor Nero is going to be looking for a scapegoat because, you probably know the story, there was a huge fire in Rome, and Nero was a great builder. And the rumour went around, it was a false rumour, almost certainly, the rumour went around that Nero had started the fire himself so he could rebuild it. And he realised this was not good. So he needed to find somebody to blame. And he asked around, oh, Christians, we blame the Christians for starting it. And he did. And many Christians were horribly tortured and killed by Nero. And in that general roundup, we believe, we're not 100% sure, but we believe that the Apostle Peter was arrested and martyred in Rome. But he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake. For the Lord's sake. There is a long-term plan here to win the world gently for the love of God through Jesus. Society, says Peter, is God's idea for our benefit. God is not an anarchist. God believes in society. And being a Christian is not an excuse to drop out of society. Doesn't the Bible say God so loved the world that he gave his only son? So why then do so many Christians retreat from it? We're not to stand on the sidelines. The Jews had confronted this at one point. If we go to Jeremiah 29, verse 7, Jeremiah tells the Jews who've been carried off to exile in Babylon, which is a pagan city, a real pagan city, massive pagan city, brutal, busy, dangerous, massive pagan city. And they hated it. They hated it. They didn't like it at all. But Jeremiah sends them a message in Jeremiah 29, verse 7. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Now, what does Peter call the Christians? He calls them exiles and migrants, does he not? And he's using the same idea. He's saying to Christians, you pray for the prosperity of the city in which you live, the society in which you live, because if it prospers, so will you. So that's, you pray for Bangor. If you're visiting us from somewhere else, you pray for where you're visiting. But let's go back. I wonder, Matt, if you could just take us back to those verses 13 to 15. Just take us back one, if that's possible, please. Bruce Winter is a theologian, and he's analysed the words that Peter is using. Where Peter talks about doing good. A couple of times he talks about doing good. And Bruce Winter, the theologian, says that's an interesting word. That's a word that you would use for a benefactor of the city. Ancient society didn't have the huge social structure and government that we have. It was, by and large, left for the people to do things themselves. So if the people wanted a festival, there wasn't a government grant to fund it. If the people wanted something built, there wasn't government money to build it. They had to find the money themselves. So they turned to public benefactors, well-to-do people in the city, in the town, who would give generous donations for public events. And they were very popular with the people. So on the day of your patron god, as it were, every town had a particular god that it would worship once a year, have a big festival. You'd have a day off, people would hang up bunting and flags and decorate their homes, and they'd have games and exciting things and food paid for by public benefactors, well-off people who would contribute towards it. And that's the word that Peter is using. People who are generous to society. And he's saying, you as Christians, you should be generous to society. Public benefactors would have a plaque to their name in the city square to show how generous and kind they were. You could supply grain. Some of the public benefactors, if the price of grain was rising, they would deliberately unload some of their stock on the market to bring the price of grain down so that common people could afford it. Now, couldn't we do with some of that in our modern society? Public benefactors. They would build public buildings. They would turn a road into a dual carriageway. They would widen it for the good of the people. They were greatly loved. It involves contribution. And I was just thinking, you know, in terms of Penrart, how do we do that? How can we do that more? I mean, look, I was looking back over last year while I was writing this. Do you think, what have we done? Well, we opened up our patio for the Olympic torch. And we fed the good people of Bangor cake and juice and biscuits. That's what we do. We're good at that. And it was greatly appreciated. Our little patch there was full of people cheering the Olympic torch, including me. I still don't know why exactly I was cheering it. But it was fun. It was fun. We helped with Bangor Carnival. And we're going to again this year. We helped run the tea tent. We helped set it up, we helped clear it up, and a couple of our church members on that committee working very hard in our name, and we need to support them. And when Brian and Anna ask for volunteers, we are public benefactors, we need to put ourselves there and say, yeah, I will come and clear up the rubbish, yeah, I'll come and set up, I will come and whatever. Listen to that cry for help, that's what church does. That's what Peter says, that's what you do as a church, you are public benefactors. We helped out with young people's work in Bangor. We helped them get some equipment they needed. We are building to use for music events. It's going to be used for another one in a few weeks' time. Local school used our building for its Christmas celebrations. Community groups use our building. Our street pastors are out there on Friday nights being public benefactors. And Peter says that's what you've got to do. That's how you're to live as public benefactors, investing time in the community. And so we finish with verses 16 and 17. And I wonder if you recognize this. Show proper respect to everyone. Can you see the triangle in this last verse? Take a look at it for a second. Look for the triangle, the up, the in, and the out. Is it there or is it not? Am I imagining this? Or am I seeing the triangle? What's the up? Fear God. What's the in? Love the brotherhood of believers. What's the out? Show proper respect to everyone and honor the King. Balanced life. Life shape. Christians. The softly approach to evangelism. Non-confrontational evangelism. Public benefactors sharing their faith. Getting involved, getting stuck in. And that's exciting. Next time, I'm away on holiday next week, but the week after we're going to dive in to a difficult one. That's all very well, but what if you're a slave? How are you supposed to live as a Christian then? We're going to look at that.